Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
From KCRW, Santa Monica, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I am honored to have as my guest someone who should have been my guest years ago. It's Harold Bloom, and he's done an anthology of the best poems of the English language. And it's from HarperCollins. It's one of the most remarkable things I've encountered. What I've said in a letter to listeners is that if you can imagine really decades worth of the most exciting lecture notes and observations compressed into one place with the addition of a personality presiding over an anthology. In other words, if you can imagine a Norton anthology by someone who is justifying his tastes and arguing against the inclusion of certain things. In other words, a book that you can read because it has a human voice, a human shape behind it. That is the best poems of the English language, and it's published by HarperCollins. Now, one of the things I noticed, Harold, is that this book is not, in any sense, a beginner's book. When I read your essay on how to begin poetry, I breathed a sigh of relief to see it's not for someone starting out, but is there a beginning?
No. Well, I think the beginning is always individual, Michael. It's that mysterious moment in the birth of the soul. It happened in me in a kind of odd way. I grew up in the Bronx speaking Yiddish, and because Mama and Papa only spoke Yiddish, and that was the language at home. And I taught myself to read English. And I don't know how it happened, but I taught myself to read English by reading the poetry of Hart Crane and William Blake without understanding what I was reading, of course, but I think you don't have to, in the early stage of reading great poetry, you don't necessarily have to be able to give a explication of what you're reading. You don't have to explain to yourself or to anyone else what this all means. I think on levels that are very deep in us and that are not just what you might want to call the unconscious mind, which has always seemed to me an oxymoron, a contradiction in terms, but on the deepest levels of the spirit, let us call it that, one is absorbing, one is soaking it in, one's imagination is beginning to come to terms with it. It can take many, many years down the road before you are able to understand what it is that you've been in love with for some time. But surely this is our experience with human beings also. And increasingly, I favor the human analog, as in your splendid introductory song about the human animal. We fall in love with family, with friends, with lovers. We don't understand them, sometimes for decades. Eventually, we haven't fully understood them because I don't think any human being, any human animal is to be fully understood. Mm. But we come to understand them better in the same way with a great poem. And eventually, you can come to understand it better because you come to know it better the way you know one another better.
As I was reading through the best poems of the English language by my guest, Harold Bloom, the editor of that book, it's an anthology that goes on its cover from Chaucer through Frost, but in fact through Hart Crane, I understood things that I hadn't understood before about your work. The first was, of course, that there is no beginning, that this book is a book that people are meant to leap into. If you don't already know poetry, wherever you begin is the beginning. And the book subscribes to a sentence that was the title of one of the translations of Isaac Babel's stories, "You must know everything."
Yes.
That
yes,
is to say
beautiful.
That to be in this world and not yes. to know our own culture and tradition, this book is meant to say you don't pick that up through inoculation or through some sudden gentle spirit chiding you into it. You have to leap, and this book is a great big leap.
I think that's very well phrased. Even though it roughly follows chronology, the very subtitle is anti-chronological. I deliberately cut it off with poets born before the 20th century. Hart Crane is born in 1899. But I put Frost in the subtitle like that because he dies in 1963, which is 8 years after Wallace Stevens dies, and therefore after anyone else in the anthology dies. And indeed, the poem most recently written in it is a poem written, I guess, during the middle or late 50s called Directive by Robert Frost. But it is anything but an academic anthology. You mentioned Norton anthologies before. Norton wouldn't publish this in 1,000 years. I've already been sent one review, which I didn't bother to read, which said, Professor Bloom is following his usual scorched earth policy towards black poets and women poets and is showing that he is a racist and a sexist. Now, this is, of course, just vicious jargon. I have deliberately, in order to avoid all issues of political correctness, cut it off with poets born in 1899. Had I extended it into poets born in the 20th century, the very first one I would have put in would be Elizabeth Bishop, and the second would have been the greatest living African-American poet, Jay Wright. That's J-A-Y-W-R-I-G-H-T. I've edited a volume of Modern Critical Views about his work. He's one of the best poets alive in the English language. Today, there was a very fine African-American poet before him, Robert Hayden, H-A-Y-D-E-N, whom I would certainly have put in. I would have turned immediately to the late Mae Swenson and the late Amy Clampett, both superb poets, of living poets in English. I would certainly have wanted John Ashbery in this country, Anne Carson in Canada, Geoffrey Hill, who's the best of the living English poets, though he lives in Boston, and Seamus Heaney, of course, who lives in his native Ireland. But I have confined myself to this area so that I could allow a rather full representation to all of the really important poets.
I'm speaking to Harold Bloom. You're listening to Bookworm, and I'm Michael Silverblatt. What I perceived most deeply from reading the essays here and from your introduction to the recent translation of Don Quixote is that books need to be considered in conversation with each other so that, in a sense, there is no Don Quixote for us without Hamlet and Falstaff. And rather than the close reading of individual poems, you provide a map of conversation that goes on spiritually from poem to poem, that the concept of the ancestral voice or even the ancestral voice overturned becomes what poems become over a lifetime of reading them. Am I right?
Oh, yes, Michael. And it's the human analog again, isn't it? Aristotle says that solitude can be sustained only if you are a beast or a god. If one is going to be other than a beast or a god, if one is merely going to be the human animal, then life essentially consists in conversation between you and your spouse, between you and your close friends, between you and your associates at work, or in my case, between my students and myself. I am, by the way, after a rather bad year last year in which I was ill in 6 or 7 ways, the whole thing climaxing with a open heart bypass surgery, which left me rather wilted indeed. I'm delighted that I'm just finishing my 50th consecutive year of teaching at Yale. And as I told the president of Yale, since the gypsies have prophesied, I'm going to be 74 this summer, that I go out at 89 years, 3 months, and 11 days, that I intend to teach another 15 years.
Have you students now that you're proud of?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I'm immensely proud of most of them. I am quite dazzled by them. In spite of all of the propaganda that one hears, both from the right and the left, the country and the world are full of deep and passionate readers. It's a kind of inalienable right that we are somehow born with, if only we can be educated to it. Readers like oneself, readers like Michael Silverblatt and Harold Bloom, they are everywhere. It astonishes me.
I was raised in what I think of still as a generation of students who had the opportunity to sit and listen to polymaths of different sorts. Ludwig von Bertalanffy, the whole systems
yes.
theorist, taught
yes.
at Buffalo, as did yes. Leslie Fiedler. Later I had the opportunity to
Leslie was an old friend, gone alas, but go on.
But magnificent minds and voices that knew how to speak, and what they put on display was that they could. That they could speak movingly, passionately, without preparation. Hugh Kenner was another. I would like to say it almost didn't matter to me what their tastes and choices were. They demonstrated that they had taste and made choices.
Yes.
I loved, though, that these people were there to teach me what it was to be a man thoughtful in the world. And that's what I thought was what my teachers did for me, because my family couldn't have.
It's very good to hear that, because after 50 years as a teacher, I still understand very little, explicitly or perhaps even implicitly, about what it is that one is doing. One is part of oral tradition. I always feel that even though I write so much, I write pretty much the way I talk and the way I teach, and I don't distinguish between reading, writing, and teaching. They're the same activity for me. But as I get older, I try to understand as I come out of a class why it seemed either particularly good or particularly bad, but it's still a mystery to me.
At the same time, in the best poems of the English language, what I relish is the evidence of a lifetime of focus on beauty and on the profound difficulty poets have in maintaining their relationship to beauty in a world that would destroy it, or in their tendency at times to reject beauty as impracticable
I know
in
only,
this world.
Yes, I am agreeing with you, Michael. I only know 3 criteria for judging a poem ultimately. One is cognitive power. Another is the achievement of some kind of aesthetic splendor or beauty. And the third is wisdom. Now, I know that all of these are debatable notions. What seems wise to one will not seem wise to another. What seems aesthetically splendid to one will not necessarily seem so to another reader. What seems to have cognitive force and originality to one will not strike another in that way. But it is a question of experience. If you spend a lifetime reading Shakespeare and teaching him, if you spend a lifetime reading Wallace Stevens and teaching him, then I think it does make a difference. I don't necessarily think it makes you a better human being, but I think it does make you a better teacher. I would like to recite, in some ways, my favorite poem, not just by Stevens, but by any modern poet, setting Hart Crane aside as a special matter, the beautiful poem called The Poems of Our Climate, which I must by now have written about a dozen times and taught in 500 classes. But you know, I want to recite it very slowly.
Please.
It is on in the anthology, if somebody has a copy. It's on page 834. It is a poem ostensibly about a flower arrangement. In fact, Stevens has been practicing the art of Japanese flower arrangement. He has come home. This was his usual practice. There are cut flowers waiting for them. He has a drink. He arranges his flowers. and one sees suddenly that it is a paradigm for not only this poem, but for all of his poetry. And it's also a meditation, by the way, which clearly is his version of Keats's Ode on a Grecian Urn, since it is profoundly allusive in regard to that. But here it is, and it's an extremely quiet poem. I think my favorite line in all of Stevens is in Notes Toward a Supreme Fiction, where he writes, "The hum of thoughts evaded in the mind."
Mm.
And what I hear in the poems of our climate is the hum of thoughts evaded in the mind. But here is this extraordinary poem. "Clear water in a brilliant bowl, pink and white carnations, the light in the room more like a snowy air reflecting snow, a newly fallen snow at the end of winter when afternoons return. Pink and white carnations, one desires so much more than that. The day itself is simplified, a ball of white, cold, a cold porcelain, low and round, with nothing more than the carnations there. Say even that this complete simplicity stripped one of all one's torments, concealed the evilly compounded vital I, that's the capital letter I, and made it fresh in a world of white, a world of clear water, brilliant edged. Still one would want more, one would need more, more than a world of white and snowy scents. There would still remain the never-resting mind, so that one would want to escape, come back to what had been so long composed. The imperfect is our paradise. Note that in this bitterness, delight, since the imperfect is so hot in us, lies in flawed words and stubborn sounds." It's a poem in which Stevens, who is the least confessional of all possible poets, but also about as profoundly subjective as Wordsworth is, which is about as subjective as you can be, without realizing it or wanting to, gives one a series of devastating insights into himself, the way in which he is trying to deeply repress his own deep passion for his attempt, as he says, to simplify it, where cold, a cold porcelain, indubitably takes you back to Keats crying out in the Ode on a Grecian Urn, "Thou silent form doth tease us out of thought as doth eternity, cold pastoral." Here the cold pastoral becomes cold, a cold porcelain, and that in some sense is the Grecian urn itself. Just as you read your way through that poem, the Grecian urn, again and again, you come to see that by the end of the poem, both you and Keats are more estranged from the vivid life, including the scene of the nymphs teasing the fauns and satyrs who are chasing them, no doubt before a glorious coition for all of them. Keats feels more and more estranged from what he is describing at the close. You spoke before about the whole question of beauty being made difficult by life, and perhaps in the end, not so much that one has to reject it, but it rejects one. And that, I think, is what is happening in the Ode on a Grecian Urn. And that is what is happening, a idiom a little closer to us now, in Wallace Stevens's The Poems of Our Climate. He has made his flower arrangement in order to achieve a reduction to what he calls the first idea, the snowman's kind of a vision. And he's been entirely too successful. He has reduced the day itself to a ball of white. He discovers that stripping oneself of all one's torments or desires simply will not work. There would still remain, as he says, the never-resting mind. You know, it's a phrase that has permanently affected my life, if one is going to speak about wisdom.
Can you help me there? I've been having an ongoing silent argument with you for many years, and it's because I tend to turn to poetry because it prizes, it seems to me, weakness or memorializes terror or speaks of the vulnerable states memorably. And I find in the criticism ongoing a call to speak of the best, genius, the strong poem, as if you were part, imaginatively, of the militarized sensibility that wants to win, as opposed to what I seem to cherish in poetry, the desire to be strong in one's loss.
I think, Michael, I am much closer to you than you realize. The wanting to win is only what, from the ancient Greeks onward, you know, Nietzsche makes the point, as did Jakob Burckhardt before him, that the difference between the ancient Greeks and the ancient Hebrews is that the Hebrews said, primarily, you must honor your father and your mother, and the Greeks said, it is necessary to have the agon, the contest, in which you win the foremost place, even if it be over against your father and your mother. There is that element, I think, in almost all great poetry, that in some sense, like Pindar, the poet writes a kind of victory ode, but that does not celebrate happiness. That only celebrates perhaps a greater capacity for loss. I deliberately ended this book with the poem that I suppose hurts me more profoundly than any other outside of Shakespeare, Hart Crane's great death poem, The Broken Tower, which is here at the very end of the book, if a reader has a copy, page 958. This is Crane absolutely bearing out what you're saying, writing, I think, his greatest single poem. But in 1932, in Mexico City, only a few months before he will leap off the deck of a ship taking him through the Caribbean back to the United States after a Guggenheim year in Mexico in which he had hardly been able to write at all, in which he was drunk and disorderly and desperate almost all the time. And here he is, profoundly at once giving you a sense of the poetic agon of the striving for the foremost place, and yet what is that foremost place except the capacity to bear even more suffering and to celebrate even more greatly human defeat, and the worst kind of defeat, the defeat in which perpetually each one of us is his or her own worst enemy. This is The Broken Tower. Just a little bit more quick dramatic background on it. He had spent the night in a jail cell there in Mexico City for his usual drunken, disorderly conduct. He had turned momentarily the only heterosexual relation of his life to Peggy Beard Cowley, the estranged wife of his friend Malcolm Cowley. Not a relationship that could last, and it did not last. It ends there on the boat as they're going back when he goes down below to the sailors again. But she figures in the poem. It is a poem in which he feels that his gift has left him, but it is as sad, as devastatingly suffering a poem as I have read in my whole life, The Broken Tower. The bell rope that gathers God at dawn dispatches me as though I drop down the knell of a spent day to wander the cathedral lawn from pit to crucifix, feet chill on steps from hell. Have you not heard? Have you not seen that core of shadows in the tower whose shoulders sway antiphonal carillons launched before the stars are caught and hived in the sun's ray? The bells, I say, the bells break down their tower and swing I know not where. Their tongues engrave membrane through marrow, my long scattered score of broken intervals, and I their sexton slave. oval encyclicals and canyons heaping the impasse high with choir, banked voices slain, pagodas, campaniles with reveilles outleaping, O terraced echoes prostrate on the plain. And so it was I entered the broken world to trace the visionary company of love. Its voice an instant in the wind, I know not whither hurled, but not for long to hold each desperate choice. My word I poured. But was it cognate, scored of that tribunal monarch of the air, whose thigh embronzes earth, strikes crystal word in wounds pledged once to hope, cleft to despair? The steep encroachments of my blood left me no answer. Could blood hold such a lofty tower as flings the question true? And then he turns to the woman sleeping by his side. Or is it she whose sweet mortality stirs latent power, and through whose pulse I hear, counting the strokes my veins recall and add, revived and sure, the Angelus of wars my chest evokes, what I hold healed, original now and pure, and builds within a tower that is not stone conjectured heaven, but slip of pebbles, visible wings of silence sown in azure circles, widening as they dip the matrix of the heart, lift down the eye that shrines the quiet lake and swells a tower, the commodious tall decorum of that sky, unseals her earth and lifts love in its shower. That's really his farewell to life and to his art, and is a poem which is a kind of triumphant crescendo of defeat, and it is the best possible exemplification of what you said was the quarrel you felt you have had with me.
Harold, may I say this? I studied Hardy and Yeats with James Wright during one summer in Buffalo. Every time I was there, I sat in the classroom with tears streaming down my face. I once missed a class, and he told me he couldn't stand to teach without me there crying. But I want to say that your voice has made me cry, and that, I'm realizing, is the entrance into poems, even if you don't know how to get through. It's that river that moves me tremendously, and it's been a real pleasure to talk to you. Thank you.
Michael, thank you very much.
I've been talking with Harold Bloom, editor of the best poems of the English language, from Chaucer through Frost, published by HarperCollins. You can read some of the poetry included in the anthology on the Bookworm page at kcrw.com. My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The technical directors have been Ray Guarna at KCRW and Phil Kearney at the Yale Media Arts Center in New Haven. Special production assistance from Alan Howard and Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. Archived editions of this and other Bookworm programs can be found online at kcrw.com, keyword Bookworm. Cassette copies are available. For ordering information, call 310-450-5183.
They're your treasured friends in prose and rhyme. Now it's book, off the mouse, pop.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.